Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Review It Yourself. I'm joined by Patrick. Oh, yeah, it's a real sigh every time.
yeah, I've listened to it. I love it every time.
It came in about 5 or 6 episodes in, I think accidentally. I don't know why. And then I use it as the kind of like the opposite of no offense to America because you're my major audience and they clearly enjoy it. But I do like just, you know, good natured jabs every now and again. But a lot of podcasts begin with the positive, like, hello, you're listening to it. I don't have that. I can try and do it, but it just comes across a bit fake. I can't help it. What could you say? Sometimes the stereotypes are true. I'm joined by Patrick from Mystopian Podcast, which has a beautiful website, by the way, if anybody wants to go check that out and read more about it. So welcome, Patrick.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No, absolute pleasure. And you have picked an absolute belter because I know for a fact, and I'm sure it happens with your podcast as well, when you do certain topics, I will get messages from people like other podcasts, because I get guests every week, who will be gutted that you've picked this one. Because part of me is thinking, surely someone's asked me to do this at some point. So I'm half expecting an angry message from someone saying, you said we'd do this, which has happened to me before. We are doing the apps. I mean, I can't praise it any higher. The build-up. Highlander, 1986. What a film. What a film, Patrick.
It is one of my favorites. It is, as we were talking before you started recording, it is absolutely of its time. It's got some highs and its lows, but it's got a magic that I think is very difficult for modern films to recapture.
Yeah, I agree. We'll get into it. But, right, you know what? I was going to kind of do the review and then come to talk about this at the end. But let's just talk about the very modern elephant in the room. The remake that they've just apparently put into production with Henry Cavill, apparently, right?
And the director from John Wick, I think, is that right? I could be wrong about that.
I don't know. To be fair, sounds about right. Modern day filmmaking. You know what? I was going to avoid it, but let's just have a bit of a chat now. Because if it was me and I'd gone into a podcast, I'd want them to face up to it. Just don't do it. Just like we were saying before, weren't we? Like, why is there never, like, you know, a man or a woman in the room like us who just loves films or loves, like, whatever they love, somebody in that meeting going, no, I'm sorry, I know we're going to make a lot of money from it. Well, a bit of money. Barely.
They're going to make a bit of money.
A bit. We might break even if we're lucky. Like, all these people around the room, like, I know, like, you just want me to be like, oh, yeah, of course. But no, not this. This is a sacred cow. Like, do not, don't do this one. Please, please don't do it.
Yeah, it's going to kill me because I guarantee you everyone in the room on the remake is going to be more talented than the people on the original, and they're still going to come up with something that just feels weak and empty.
Yeah, well, it's happened before. Like, very rarely does it work. I know that we've had some outliers. What's the word, Carl Urban in it? Was it Robo? No, not Robo. Was it Robo?
The Dread? The remake?
Judge Dredd, yeah.
That one's was decent. RoboCop remake's terrible.
Yeah, sorry, the Judge Dredd one I meant. slipped up there. There's outliers, but most of the time, it just doesn't work. Like the Colin Farrell Total Recall.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, it's not even worth, and this is me saying it, it's not even worth, like, getting annoyed about, because it's just like, why did you bother? Why did you, you know?
It's just so ephemeral. Like, some of these remakes, sometimes you forget that they even did it. It's just gone so quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just think, like, why? Like, if you want to make a film like it, then make a film like it and have, like, something with similar rules, but don't give it strength on its own merit. If you want to make a story about immortals, knock yourself out.
Yeah.
But don't trade on, oh, everybody get into the cinema. Because I think this is where the crux of the matter for me comes in. They want you in on the strength of the name. So if they said, oh, it's this film we've made about a post-apocalyptic future, it's got no one in it that you know. It just doesn't happen now, but it's got no one in it you know. It's a bit like Terminator. It's a bit like this. They won't make that. It could be a million times better. They'd rather bring out Terminator 8, the nursing home, because they'll trade on the name, even though everybody goes... Like, it's terrible. So that's the issue. It's like, no, if you want to make a film, make it, but don't trade on the name, because they have this fallacy in their head that, oh, well, that's the only thing that gets people in the cinemas. No, it doesn't. What gets people at the cinemas is, like, some films have, like, massive word of mouth, and it still works. Like, some of the films recently, like, I think theater you guys call it over there, but the cinema over here, it's not cheap to go and see. You're talking, like, I mean, you're talking at least 12 quid, you know, like, probably about $10, you know, whatever it is over there, £10 to £15 over here to go see a film.
Per ticket.
You know, if you've got a wife or a partner or a couple of kids or friends or nieces or nephews, even if the children, those prices are no longer cheap. So, and you know, on top of it, it's the fuel to get to the, or gas to get to the cinema. You have to pay for parking. You're probably going to want a bit of food before, a few drinks before, soft or otherwise. You know, the kids might want a bit of popcorn. It's not cheap. So, you know, you really pick what films that you go and see now. And for me, I go off what people tell me, whether that's other podcasters or friends or YouTubers that I watch who review films. I will very much, if I watch a YouTuber that I enjoy and, you know, 9 times out of 10, I agree with, and they say, you know what, this isn't bad, this, I might give that a go, actually. Whereas if not, you know, I am very, you know, sometimes I just want to go see it, but a lot of times I'll just think, like Saw X, I waited to listen to what people told me before I decided whether or not to just wait for the DVD. I'm old fashioned, or to go to streaming rather than I would to go see. I mean, I don't know if you're similar, but I think these are the things they forget when they make these decisions that, like, do you know, like the issue that people have, it's like, well, do I go to the cinema or do I put some money on the bill? You know, there's not much of a battle there now. You know, it's a big issue they've got to sort out, but no one seems to.
Yeah, they're extremely risk averse. And like you said, they only think that people will go see things if we recognize the property. But I feel like that is more and more not working. Like, we very much are based off of, it's a review culture now. And it is review culture from stuff like this. It's not.
Thank,
like,
God.
Yeah, you're right. It's not like Roger Ebert telling us something is good. It's just this word of mouth, small, like, indie podcasters, indie YouTubers going like, oh, this is actually a really interesting film. That I think gives you, like, the options to play with things, but budgets are so high, they don't want to take a chance on a film like this. They'd rather remake it. And like I said, we're going to forget about the fact that it, you know, that's going to come out. And we're going to be like, oh, that was disappointing, and nothing will come of it.
Yeah. No, I risk averse. Yeah. This is what happens. Guests come on and sum up what I've said in 5 minutes in 2 words, but it's not always the way. But no, I can't say any better. It's stifling cinema. Like, there's no choice across the board. There's a couple of superhero films and there's a couple of quieter films, but because it's so expensive, I actually look at films now and go, well, can I enjoy that on the small screen as much as the big screen?
Yeah.
Like, there's some films that you think, no, I have to go and see this on the big screen, you know, Dunkirk, films that you know belong on the big screen. But a lot of the time I just think, I'll wait for it to come out. You know, it doesn't bother me.
Yeah. And we have a kid, like, we have to do that all the time. Like, you just, you know, if we have to get a sitter and then go to a movie, like, that's a huge thing for us. So.
Well, yeah, that costs money as well.
Yeah.
So even if it's a friend, it's still going to, or a family friend or whatever, it's still going to cost you money. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is what I mean. And you just don't remake Highlander. It's obviously just don't do it. And don't get me wrong, I would love, there's nothing I'd like more than to be proved wrong.
That's true, right? Like if they made an amazing Highlander film, like, that would be awesome. Like, I would love to be wrong. I just have no faith that that would happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Especially not some of the films we've got coming out now. I mean, we'll get into it, but, like, I think the biggest issue is writing. Now, as people know who listen to the podcast, I don't get into the politics of it, but I think writing now is absolutely diabolical, almost across the board. Like, whereas you watch some of these older films and the writing's absolutely marvelous, and you think this is spot on. And it just, I don't know what's happened to writing. I think it's so poor on films now, or it's so simplistic to the point of it feels like you've been insulted.
Yeah, I've got some theories on that. I think a lot of it has to do with focus groups. and reshoots that are trying to figure out what a focus group wants, and also like multiple passes and having ghostwriters, like just so many people working on a script. Yeah. It just doesn't have a viewpoint anymore.
Yeah, because sometimes the well, to be fair, right, going back to like not even that long ago, most modern example, even though I'm not a massive Lord of the Rings fan, perfect example, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings. He goes, this is my vision for Lord of the Rings. I'm going to be very faithful. This is my vision. That's what I'm doing. End of story. Bit like Nolan. To your detriment or not, I'm the director. This is my story. This or here's a story. This is the vision. This is what I'm going to make. Spielberg's very much the same, which is why I wonder, maybe that's why him and Tom Cruise don't work together. But that's a discussion for another day, which I think I've had before. So, you know, we don't have that. Like you've just said, it's like, you know, it's like trying to make the world's best cocktail. Or at least a cocktail a lot of people drink. And then you've got 20 people just shotting all this shit in. And you go, what do you do? Like, no. What are you doing? I wanted to make a nice mojito. Now I've got every spirit in the sun under it. You've diluted it. It's awful. What's this? Oh, well, we wanted something that appeals to everyone. That's another issue they've got now. Something to appeal to everyone. No, you can make films that are very much, we know who this is for. And not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. Like Highlander is not for everyone, and that's okay. I think the reason that it works is because it is, I don't want to say target in terms of like who it's trying to reach, but it's not trying to reach everyone. Absolutely. It's a weird film. I was rewatching it today and just the beginning of the movie, like the number of like what the fuck moments that happen just in immediate succession. There's a lot of people who are going to be turned off by that. There's a lot of people who are going to be extremely intrigued, like what's happening, what's going on.
I had some, because I haven't seen it in it might be 10 years, it's been a long time. It's just not something I don't think I saw it when I was younger, so it doesn't have the nostalgia for me, but I'm too old to have been around when it was out. Too young, sorry. But it is a good film, and like it's one of those films where you know when you put it on you're going to enjoy it, but I'd forgotten some of the moments that are just very like, oh okay. And because we're so used to watching, not that I watch a lot of, but we are used to the way media is now. When you watch a film like this, where it's very much like, this is the 80s, we're going to make what we want, end of story. And it's, you watch it now and it's like, ooh, okay, all right, fair enough. So it's like, but that's just not always a bad thing. Like I said, we'll get into it. So thanks for bringing us back onto a Highlander, Patrick, because someone had to. So, Highlander was directed by Russell McKay. So I'm going to read from the back of the DVD case now. It's a bit of a long one, so strap yourselves in. Usually these are terrible, but this isn't a bad one. For anybody who's been living under a Highland rock and doesn't know about Highlander, he fought his first battle on the Scottish Highlands in 1536. He will fight his greatest battle on the streets of New York City in 1986. See, first sentence, you're already locked in. His name is Conor McLeod. He is immortal. Conor McLeod, Christopher Lambert from Mortal Kombat and Subway, survives a wound that should kill him in a clan battle in the Scottish Highlands in 1536 and is banished from his village. Years later, McLeod is met by, see if I can get it right, Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, Sean Connery from The Untouchables, another great film where he plays, his accent's all over that one. It's unbelievable. The Hunt for Red October, again, a Russian-Scottish man. You can't beat it. A swordsman who teaches McLeod the truth about himself. He is immortal, one of a race of many who can only die when the head is cut from the body. When one immortal takes the head of another, the loser's power is absorbed into the winner in a rather graphic way. I've added that little bit at the end. Ramirez teaches McLeod the ways of the sword until he is killed by his gravest foe, the evil Kurgan. Clancy Brown, The Shawshank Redemption, and he's been in many, many more since then.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Unbelievable. Who lusts for the, again, you're not going to replace him, but we'll get into it. Who lusts for the ultimate power, the immortals, the prize, enough power to rule the earth forever. McLeod must fight his way through the centuries until the time of the gathering, when the few immortals who have survived the ages will come together to fight until only one remains. In New York City, the final battle is about to begin, and in the end, there can only be one. A bit like your favorite podcast. I'm joking. But yeah, I mean, just read. I mean, yeah, it is. It's a bit out there. I mean, I've no doubt that some people would be like, no. But what a film. I mean, yeah, I just loved it. And I'd forgotten the beginning where they have that something they used to do in old fashioned films like Zulu, The Great Escape, where they would read out what happened at the end or the beginning, like the introduction. I'd forgotten that was there about moving silently through the centuries. Just it has such a brilliant tone. I love the feel of it. How about yourself?
Oh yeah, like so it starts with that Sean Connery, you know, beginning, which sets the thing about immortals and moving silently through the centuries and all that. And then they hit you with Queen with a pretty awesome song.
Yeah.
Which I really feel like sets the tone of like, this is going to be a really badass movie.
Yeah.
And then you've got the wrestling, which I don't know. Did you grow up with wrestling? I don't know how popular wrestling is in the UK.
I've got friends who really liked it when it was like the WWF, which then became WWE because of the whole. So I had friends who watched it. So like, you know, the Hulk Hogan and all that kind of thing. It was that kind of era, like the late 90s, early 2000s. Like I had friends who loved it, but I wasn't really into it. But by proxy, I know a bit about it because of them. Just in the same way, I had a lot of friends who went to F1 around the same time. So I could probably name like Raikkonen and all them kind of F1, but I was never into it, but by proxy. So a bit of a long-winded answer, but yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, so you got the fabulous Thunderbirds in them, like in Madison Square Garden, and that beautiful shot of the camera like going all the way around. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you were immediately hit with the fact that, and Russell Mulcahy was a director of music videos, but this is a guy who's going to add a lot of visual panache.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it zooms in to, you know, Lambert, like up in the stands, and then you get the rise up and the wipe, and suddenly you're in the Highlands. Like, it is wild there.
I've got so many discussions. I've got so many notes about the transitions in this film. I didn't think I was a Ponzi podcast film reviewer, but I really enjoy transitions, I've realized, in watching this film. Because it's just, it keeps your attention. Again, remake. Who the hell are you going to pick that gets anywhere near Queen? Sorry, there's no one. There's literally no one. Because as you said, straight from the off, you have this old-fashioned traditional scroll, and then it's like, so again, perfectly sums up the film. It's like, oh, he's this like really traditional, you know, and it's like bang, straight literally like in the face with Queen 80s, and it's perfect in the most odd way. Like, it shouldn't work, but it does. And
yeah, like it's hokey, but in a way that you don't mind. It's hokey kind of without being cheesy, if that makes sense.
It's so self-confident, this film, though.
Yes.
Like, it feels self-confident in that, like, you don't feel like it was someone just throwing enough shit and seeing something stuck, or, like, trying to make something that was just weird, like Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. It feels like they were literally just like, yeah, this is the tone we're going for. And we know what we're doing. You might not get it yet, but you will. You'll get it in about half an hour.
And I have a feeling it's a lot of cocaine and maybe unearned confidence, but it works.
Well, we get a mention about that later on. The old, if you want broads, what is it? If you want broads or blow, press or. So there you go. and again, like I have that first note was about the awesome shot around the arena. Didn't know it was Madison Square Garden, so that's pretty cool. Of course, it's New York. Duh. But today that would be a drone shot, and it would be quite sanitary, like if they would do it at all, because it's a bit clunky in the way it moves, because obviously of the way they had to do it, but in a way that's better, because, you know, I mean, I sometimes I've been accused, the wrong word, but well, no, it's not, of being like stuck in a nostalgia trap. But this film has no nostalgia for me, in that, as I said before, I didn't see it when I was younger, so it's not like it's a film that I give a pass because it has fond memories. I didn't see it till I was a fair bit older, I don't think. Maybe like in my teens, but I think my dad might have put it on. But they have the way they did things back then was, I just think it was better. I mean, it comes around the same time as, you know, the diehards. And if they brought back matte paintings into films now, I think they should, for like those locations, just bring back matte paintings. Or false miniatures and stuff like that. Just bring it back, because I think people would be like, yeah, okay. Because CGI has got to a point where it either looks marvelous or it looks absolutely awful. So there's like no in between. And especially when, you know, it used to be like when Terminator came out, and even films like The Lawnmower Man, which I know is a bit out there, But they used to say, oh my God, like from the people who like from the effects team of Terminator 2, it was, oh my God, this is going to be good. Whereas now it's like so much of the discussion is like, yeah, this just looks awful. And it's like, you've undercut it so much. Like the fight scenes in this are unbelievable. Like where they're running across the tops of the cars in the big car park. And it's like, yeah, this is what I want to see because it's real. I don't think you can't buy that kind of authenticity. And again, it's an issue I have with modern films where, and I'm trying, I apologize, listeners and Parik, I'm trying not to make this me moaning about modern films. I'm trying not to. I'm desperately trying not to fall in that trap. Yeah, okay. So the music as well. I thought at the beginning, it's kind of Die Hard-esque, but obviously this was before. But and then I looked and yeah, it is Michael Kamen. And I've been really watching the Lethal Weapon films. I've never seen them before, so I've been watching those recently with the Decision Reel. Those have like the similar music. And yeah, Michael Kamen, the late Michael Kamen. God, he did some great music, but you can always kind of tell it's him. It's a bit like Hans Zimmer. You can always kind of tell it's him, but yeah, he doesn't do the same thing. So yeah, and I also, I'd love to know what you thought about this. I love the fact that it's sword fighting, that guns are just pointless. Like I love that. The fact that
I do too.
Like, yeah, we're gonna have a Japanese samurai sword and we're gonna have a guy with a massive sword with these, and it's like what there's a guy with like a machine gun. Yeah, he shoots him and it doesn't do anything. I just love that. Because it's the tone.
That's probably what got me into this at the beginning. I actually didn't watch the film when I was younger. I watched the TV show from the 90s. And I really got into that, like staying at my grandmother's house because she had cable and we didn't. And it would come on the USA Network. And so that's what I watched. And just this, like, sword fights are just awesome. And they look really cool. And it's one of those things that I think allows a lot more fluid of a fight scene. If it's just punching, it's kind of boring. If it's just, you know, shooting each other, like the bullets miss, but you can do a lot more with a sword fight and make it a lot more cinematic. And it's Bob Anderson, the guy who did the Star Wars things, who choreographed it.
Right. Well, see, I'm not a massive Star Wars guy. I'm a Star Trek guy, but to be fair, I do agree because I've watched a lot of stuff now where they have kind of sword fighting in it. And it's like, it looks like they are people who have been choreographed to fight. And you're just like, oh, really? And it just doesn't work. Whereas this does feel very, very raw and very real. And to be fair, I haven't lived under a rock. I have seen clips of the lightsaber battles, and they look pretty cool. I'm not a big fan of the films overall. I've just never got it. My dad would never have them on. That's another story. So, a guy who clearly knows what he's doing. And it comes across. It really does. And also, like, be interested again to see what you think about this. Like, I love the 1980 effects. I think in a weird way, like the electricity and stuff, I think in a weird, strange way, it dates it in a good way because it makes it feel like that's what the magic of these immortals would look like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those things that you could easily knock it because it doesn't really follow a very easy logic. Like sometimes it does some things and sometimes it does other things. But yeah, like it is one of those things that when they have these weird, like magical orgasms, which is what it always looks like.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of a strange thing. But like you said, it's like it's setting off cars, it's, you know, making glass explode, they're getting struck by lightning. First of all, it's different every time, which I think is more visually interesting. You're always kind of wondering what it's going to be to the end where he's like spiraling in the air and dragons are going around him, like cartoon stuff. Like it's just fun in a way that, like, if it was CG, I don't know what would be fun about it.
No, I mean, it's funny because I'd actually forgotten that happens. And I'd remembered they absorbed the power, but I'd forgotten how it manifested. So when I watched the bit where he kills the guy in the car park at the beginning and he like all the cars and he like the cars start moving, I was like, what's this? Even though I have seen the film a few times, I was like, what's this? I don't remember this bit. And these bits later on where I think there's some, because I have, I think, what's the director's cut, but that's apparently what they release outside of America. Yeah.
It's only got a few small. I think the director's cut of this one is pretty close to the original cut. Like, they don't go straight to the Highlands at the beginning, and they don't have the World War II scene. But I think otherwise, it's pretty close.
See, mine did. Mine does have that.
Yeah.
So yeah, but that not massive differences, but and again, love the transitions. That'll be said so many times. So apologies if you get bored of hearing anybody, but.
Well, you think about it, you had to do something interesting with these transitions. You're going from the 1500s to the 1980s, and it would be jarring if you didn't do it in an interesting way. Yeah. And every single time, it's like revealing what the character is thinking or what is reminding him about the past. And so it always works really well, both in a like visual way and also in a character way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And it doesn't feel forced either. Because, you know, we start off in 1537. McLeod is stabbed in battle, you know, there can only be one, by who turns out to be the Kurgan later on, and he gets stopped before he can behead him. And again, like, I'll have to explain now, because usually what I do with these reviews, just a regular review itself, we tend to just talk through the plot and the conversation comes from that. The problem is, and I've done this before, when I'm enjoying a film this much, my notes aren't very good. They're just like random like sentences, so that I have to work out what I'm talking about. So if it comes across a bit, so all I've put next was awesome transition into his pupil. Again, love that one. You know, it comes out like from his eye.
Yeah, that's where he's like dead on the field and it like goes up through his eye. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
See, I don't write the context. I just write like a little bit and I've only just watched it and I can't remember what it's about. and I just, again, like I, like, let's just caveat it before we get into it. Some of the dialogue does date the film and not in the most flattering of lights. You know, there's the whole bit about where the guy which I don't disagree. It probably would have happened in this situation.
Talking about the cop and the homophobia.
Yeah, the cop and essentially, he's kind of saying, oh, did you go down there to, you know, meet up? And, you know, then you, and I thought, that's a bit of a weird stretch, but that's where you're going to go. But I did. But
it
love...
does also feel of it like that's probably one of the
I reckon that's what they've said. Yeah, that's what they would have said. There's a lot of things in this where, yeah, it comes across like very unflattering to modern ears, but that is no doubt what would. And I've no doubt if this situation happened now, they might look at it that way as well and think, well, what would. Let's look at all the possibilities of why these two guys are meeting in this, you know. And yeah, they wouldn't approach it like they do in this. But I think it would still be a possibility. But you don't know.
I have to say, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but I love how incompetent the cops are in this movie. It makes me laugh the entire time. One of my favorite scenes is the newspaper guy like heckling him. It's so funny to me. And the cops, they just have no idea what's going on. And eventually they just disappear from the plot.
Well, yeah. But I love that as well, though, because in a lot of films, you get like the feel of a place. And from like, I've only got family who've been to I've never been to New York, North Carolina, as far as I got. But yeah, again, going back to the dialogue, absolutely, like, it's just brilliant. Like, my favorite line of the whole thing is, and I can't do the Scottish accent. No, I can't. He's a Highlander by God. The last sound he hears shall not be that of a wailing woman.
Yeah.
Just like brilliant, because that's again how people would have talked to women. And it's a bit like later on where he's like, he tells her like, shut up woman, or stop it. Well, that's
right,
how
when,
people
when
at that
Ramirez
time
first shows up, he's like, get in the house, and she says, I'll stay right here, do what I say, woman.
Yeah, well, that's how it would have been. So
it would have been like it's more realistic.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course it is. And now it's like, it would have been unrealistic for her to stand there, because there's no reason for it to be there. Whereas nowadays, if they made the film, they might be like, oh, well, we can't really have a man tell a woman to shut up. No, it's not about that. I agree with the sentiment, but it's a film set like 500 years ago or whatever it is. Like, it's not
right. Do we really be worried about how likable the protagonist is, where it could be an opportunity to show growth? You could show him not being like that now, but like, absolutely, he would have been that like that then.
Yeah. Well, because, yeah, he's immortal, but he's only been alive for, like, 40 years at that point or whatever it is. So, again, with some of the... as much as it's not acceptable in the workplace nowadays at all, I did really, really laugh when the guy again with the cops, where he's like, oh, this one came unassembled, and then the other guy who's just like, good to see you, Brenda, you look pretty, Brenda. Like, where did that come from? Like
there's a lot of cops who are in this movie who are just unfazed by the remarkable violence of the beheadings. Like somebody yells and cover up the head. Like,
yeah. I mean, they are New York cops in the 1980s. They've probably seen a fair bit of, you know, a fair bit of stuff. But yeah, my next note is like, I love how jaded they are. Like where there's a bit where a guy says something like, with the outdated stereotypes, where the guy says something like, oh, he gets off the phone and he's like, oh, it's his Vietnamese neighbor ate his dog.
Yeah.
And then someone else is like, oh, well, it's Jersey. And it's like,
yes.
What? Like, I just thought that was, I love it. It's hilarious. And I love the fact that they call out how like weird he talks. So like, yeah, the guy's like, you talk funny, where are you from? Because I love this film and I'm not Scottish, but I live close enough to Scotland to know he sounds more Russian than he does Scottish.
I'm someone who like just doesn't care about accents when it comes to films. Yeah. Like the actor's doing their best. You want him to be good, and sometimes you hear a laughable one is really bad. But in the end, sometimes I feel like we've got too high of standards of things. It's like, yeah, you know, does it sound better? It's fine. But I do think that there's a difference between his Scottish accent, which is, I know, not a good Scottish accent when he's younger in the movie.
It's not that bad, though. I mean, don't get me wrong. I might have come across a bit like not how I might do. I love Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and I love Kevin Costner in that. I would rather he did it with his normal accent than he tried to do in English, and it was just embarrassing. So the film's that good, I'll overlook it. Well, Alan Rickman is at least, but yeah. Anyway,
Alan Rickman, amazing. But you know, like his more modern version, like the 1986 version of him, does kind of have this like world, like kind of mixed accent that clearly like picks up some things, like which might be just Christopher Lambert himself, you know, being French and speaking English, maybe picked up some different stuff. But if you lived that long, your accent would slide all over the place.
Oh God, yeah, absolutely. And he's been to France because they're never in the scene where he saves Rachel, who's a Jewish child from the Holocaust and from the Nazi officer. He's clearly in France, because I thought, apologies, I know not everybody knows history or likes history as much as I do, and I thought some people thought, because she spoke like really perfect English in terms of her accent, little kid, I thought people might have thought that was England. It's like, yeah, they didn't land in England.
Yeah.
They got the Channel Islands just off the coast of France, which is technically which is UK territory, but they didn't get to. So I think it's meant to be France, certainly, or at least Belgium or one of the Low Countries or somewhere where the Nazis occupied. Could have been a lot of countries, but they never really kind of tell you where it is. So it's clearly, just to back up your point, it's clearly been all over the place. And of course, the meeting other people, and I've no doubt you'd become kind of a social chameleon, wouldn't you? Because they've got to blend in. They've got to, again, you know, slide silently through the centuries. They don't want to make a lot of noise. Like, this is where it might be a good time to go to Christopher Lambert's portrayal, actually, because he's very understated in this. He's very, like, dour and morose. But you would be, because if you've lived for 500 odd years, they don't want to stand out. They want to be quiet. They want to not get noticed. That kind of Men in Black feel. They don't want to stand out in a crowd, do they, at all, because then they'll get noticed.
Yeah, bringing up how kind of quiet his performance is, I don't know what his lines of dialogue are, but there's lots of scenes where he doesn't seem to say a lot, and he does kind of just have, you know, this look on his face that just looks tired.
He's like world weary, isn't he? He's like, you know, you would be, wouldn't you?
Yeah, yeah. Everybody you've ever known has died around you, which is like, I don't know if the modern romance, really works in this movie with Brenda. But the concept of it is really a good idea. Somebody who was in love and can't be in love, like just completely has turned that part of himself off, and having that come back conceptually makes sense. I don't think the Brenda stuff works. I think the Heather stuff works, but I don't think the Brenda stuff works.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It feels a little bit nice. for the end of the film. Whereas the rest of it, it's not been about it being nice or working as a film. Whereas that's the only bit where it's like, feels like you kind of needed to have that because, but no, I agree. I had a good point there that to follow on from what you said, but it's gone. Never mind. It'll come back to me. yeah. I mean, she notices that this very rare sword, this Toledo Salamanca broadsword. And just, I mean, how, oh, so, yeah, that was what it was. As well, is that I thought about his portrayal, and they don't look into how it would make him feel, because it's not that kind of film, and thank God it isn't. But if the only place you're truly safe is a church or a holy ground, then you're forever on guard. So you don't really have time to be like, you know, wistfully thinking about all this, because he just doesn't have time. He needs to just remain quite focused, otherwise, as you know, Ramirez says to him, if you know your head leaves your neck, it's all over.
Can you imagine being hunted all the time? Like that sounds so incredibly stressful constantly.
I literally thought watching this, what about a bath? Like, does he literally have to like lean the sword up against him? He must have to. Because you don't know when it's gonna come. And I like the way they have it in the film where they meet others. And I thought there was more, but maybe I'm thinking of the sequels at all. But where they have like others that, you know, they meet up every couple hundred years and say, oh, how are you doing? And it's been a while, literally, type thing. So I quite like that. And again, it's a film that gives you little bits, like little nuggets every now and again, which I prefer rather than the whole, oh, we're going to tell you all the plot way of doing things. I did enjoy that. And I like what did work for me with the Brenda stuff was the fact that at first he's like, shut up, don't follow me again. If you value your life, just don't come near me again. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense, because he doesn't have time for like that nice. He's like, no, just go away. Like, I'm involved in stuff. Just like, I don't have time for you. Like, away you go. But yeah, what can you? Yeah, that's the bit that works for me. I think the romance bit, not so much. And speaking of women, in terms of the film, the beginning, the woman that was a bad transition. Speaking of that, there's good transitions, Highlander transitions, and then there's that. All I meant by that is he has a woman who's like at the beginning, she's like, fight for me and think of me and
flower. And his girlfriend at the very beginning,
who I know, she's been in quite a few British TV. I can't think of her name off the top of my head. And yeah, she literally is just like, and then he comes back and she's like, he's the devil, kill him, burn him. And I'm like, God, she turned quick.
The quick turnaround of that, which again, I do think is realistic. I feel like people would have been very frightened at someone like that. But she gets so much glee from the concept of his, you know, burning that is wild.
It really isn't. And again, like what I liked about it, and talking of realism, like it doesn't pull any punches. Like Angus, who is also in Braveheart and is a Scottish actor as well.
Which one's Angus? Is that the older one or the younger one?
The older one.
He's in Game of Thrones. Yeah.
Yes, he is. He's also plays Hamish's dad in Braveheart as well. He convinces the others to banish him. And I was thinking, well, he doesn't really convince them. He just kind of says to him, get out of here now while I keep these talking. Because you've got, you know, his not girlfriend anymore, like, no, burn him. And you're like, calm yourself down. But again, like with the portrayals of with the film, like it's like thoughtful in a very understated way. Like the men are morose, gritty, dirty. I like the brooding, quiet. But they're awesome, like, I think there's nothing wrong with having like central male characters who act like this, where they aren't very much like talking about their feelings and stuff. Like, yeah, there's a place for that. And in real life, you know, everybody should talk about their feelings. But in terms of films, it's like, there's nothing wrong with having a character like this, who's very much like, is an island. I don't want people so much. And again, they don't just tell you that, or they show you with the whole, is it Rachel?
Yeah.
No.
Blossom. Well, Rachel's his daughter, adopted daughter.
No, sorry, first. Is it Blossom I'm thinking of? His wife? Who was his wife?
Heather, who he calls Blossom.
That's it. And again, they show that with it. Although there was a part in it where she walks out and she's like, pie and ale? And I'm like, I'm living in the wrong year. Living around here. I'm northern. Give me pie and a lager and I'm good to go.
You know, despite the fact that he's very morose a lot, mm-hmm. he yeah. also has a sense of humor about him that doesn't come across yeah. as super jokey. It literally sounds like someone making a joke to themselves in the way that you yeah. would. And he kind of, you know, like when the Kurgan first attacks him, and he's like, oh, nice to see you too. And I really enjoy those really small bits of humor. I feel like a little goes a long way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, yeah, look at what's happened in more modern films where they have this brand or type of humor. And it's like, oh, it's so generalized. And there's a lot to be said for nuanced. I think it plays a lot better because it doesn't treat you like an idiot.
Right. Yeah, like a modern film, they would have an actual comedian give those lines, and the lines would be funnier, but they would mean less in the film.
Yeah, whereas like other times when it's like a little bit downplayed, or where it's an actor who's very much, I don't know why this line's in my head, because it's what came in my head. It's like Will Smith in Men in Black, where he like steps on the cockroach and he's like, oh, was that your auntie? Like, I love that. I'm like, it's like, where did that come from? You know, stuff like that, where it's like, that's a bit more of it. But yeah, I agree. I do like that kind of humor where you can just enjoy it for what it is. And I do think this film, because I'm dying to kind of watch it again, even though I've literally just finished it. I think it benefits from like repeat viewings. I think you'd probably pick up more the more you watched it. And then, I mean, we've not talked about him long enough. I can't believe how little he's in this, Sean Connery, to be honest. Because my memory yeah. was like, he was in it a lot. He's in like 20 minutes, but he's brilliant.
Yeah, he was on set for a week, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's an Egyptian, come Spanish, come Scottish, come God knows what.
He's been to Japan because he talks about the samurai's daughter, and that's yeah. where he got his sword from. He's again, awesome.
The depth of characters as well. Like, you feel like you know so much about these characters, but there's barely any. There's not a lot of like dialogue in this film. It's not like they sat around telling you loads of stuff. It's like you were saying about quiet moments. It's like the scene between Ramirez and Heather where they sat around the table, and I don't know yeah. where McCloud is. I don't know where he's gone, but it's not.
And they don't even bother to explain it. And they don't have to.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Because you imagine how forced it would have been like, well, I could have saved him, but I was picking lilies at the lock. You know, it wouldn't have worked. Right. You know what I mean? It would just been like, oh God. But yeah, I do. I mean, Hans Sanchez, Villalobos, Ramirez, just great. And they have that classic like training element of it, but it's just so well done.
I love that training scene.
Yeah, brilliant, isn't it?
And you know, them filming in Scotland, it just looks gorgeous. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a beautiful part of the world, particularly the Highlands. And he explains about the sensation, which is called the quickening. We're not going to go there. I've only just met Patrick. I don't know him well enough yet to crack those kind of jokes. And again, like that lightning transition back to New York City. I was like, oh, it's brilliant. The transition from the fish tank to the lock.
Oh,
it's just.
Oh yeah, that's on. Really good.
Yeah. And the dialogue, like, you can't drown your fool, you're immortal, or you have the manners of a goat. I can't do Connery. I don't even ask. And the whole like the haggis stuff, but it did make me laugh watching Sean Connery asking somebody what haggis is,
right?
Because he clearly would know. But I'm like, it's part of the charm. Like, I will let things go when I enjoy a film as much as this. I am a bit of a stickler, but sometimes it's just like, no, just this film is very much a. It's not a turn your brain off film, because that's unfair, but it's very much a go with us and have a great time. It's a bit like an M. Night Shyamalan film, which sounds not as extreme, in that you either accept what's put in front of you and you run with it and have a great time, or you sit there going, no, I don't like this. No, this doesn't make sense. It's stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. If you didn't buy into this, there's a lot that you could complain about in this movie. But if you buy in, like it's all amazing.
Oh, yeah. And again, speaking of buying into things, I mean, you get Victor Kruger as the punk. Mr. Kurgan as a punk in New York City, like, in the late 80s. Just like, that works so yeah. well. And again, like, the film has, like, little messages as well. Like, I mean, I don't even need to give examples because it can apply to anybody. But the whole, like, because you are born different, men will fear you and try to drive you away. Like, that's such, in a film like as daft as this. It's not silly, but it is a bit daft. And like as fantastical and the sci-fi elements in it. But to give a message like that, it's like, yeah, that makes sense, whether it's because you were bullied or whatever. Like, yeah. That's such a... And I was like, I was not expecting to be given a message like that amongst all this, which shows you can have films like this, which I've no doubt people might accuse of being very, very macho and very kind of dark and that kind of thing. But you know, you can have a film like that, but it also give important messages. Not that films have to have messages, because I've argued that a lot of times, but it can have like a theme and giving you something to reflect on, not necessarily telling you how to feel, which is, I think, something that modern films try and do, which does my head in. Yeah, try not to go off on one, but yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Oh, I completely agree. And I would argue that I don't even know if the filmmakers are trying to have a message. I think the best messages come when it just kind of relates to the theme and relates to the characters, yeah. And it just kind of naturally comes out.
Oh, yeah, because that is like something that makes sense to what said to him. They probably didn't consider it or think as deeply about it, because I don't think they were worried about that. I think they were just like, how do we sort this shot out? How do we sort this, this sword fighting bit out? And again, Ramirez, just for people who might not have seen the film, and if you haven't, go watch it, really. Just to say that you have. Ramirez tells him about the rules, so we must fight until only one remains. You are safe only on holy land. Like, we can't fight on it. Your head comes away from your neck. It's all over. They can't have children, which causes a bit of a shock. And he also warns him, like, don't form close relationships. But it's very much a do as I say, not as I do kind of thing. Because he's clearly, like, I've had a relationship with... He got married to the Japanese lady and that, you know, that kind of killed, like, crushed him and that kind of thing. But it's that whole thing. Again, you're right. They probably weren't thinking about this. But it almost asks the question of, is it better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all? Is it?
Right.
Or, you know, because that all does it... I think, again, going back to Men in Black, which is a surprisingly really good film, where I think Will Smith... Jay says something to Kay about it, about that woman he logs onto the computer to look at. She thinks his wife or something, and he's like, "Oh well, better to have loved." And he's like, "Yeah, try it." I quite like that. Oh yeah. Anyway, yeah. I don't know why. Maybe I don't know why I'm in Black's in my head. I really don't. and yeah, as you were saying, just the locations are absolutely beautiful. And then Ramirez, of course, warns him, "Look, if Kurgan wins, like, mankind will suffer." Like this age of darkness, because this guy's got like no scruples. Like, he will kill, attack. There's no lines he won't go to. And I was surprised when I was watching it. I was like, oh, this is darker than I remembered. And it's only a 15. I was like, really? I thought, like, it's like, I don't know who was writing this one, but yeah, it's
there's a lot of, like, I mean, there's sexual assault, there's murder, like, there's not a lot of blood, I guess, but there's a lot of implied violence.
Maybe that's why they got away with it, because it's implied. But sometimes I think implied's worse, because you've got a
imagination.
Yeah. And I've got to say, like, another one of my favorite parts was just the way Clancy Brown says Ramirez.
Like, oh, so good.
And then I just like love the back and forth between him and Connery, where it's like, oh, can I do it? No, I heard it in my head. My cuts improved your voice. All that, like, I can't. My cuts improved your voice. And again, like, that Ramirez and Kurgan fight, like, yeah, there's a little bit of effect in there, but overall, that's such a spectacle. Like, the walls are blowing out.
Right.
Like, it's such a good scene. And it's like, if you were ever, like, if you're an actor or whatever your profession is, and somebody told you could go out like that, like, oh, we're gonna make this scene, and this is how you die, it'd be like, yeah. All right, and I mean, not in real life. And if you're acting, and they went, "This is how you're going to go down." Yes, please. Like, it's such a good scene.
Such a good scene. And you were talking about the rules. It reminded me how brilliant the rules are for the way that it paces the film. So, for example, they can't fight on holy land. That means that at the end, you have this scene with the protagonist and the antagonist who get to sit down together and have a conversation, and they can't fight. Yeah. And it's great.
Oh, this is just the way he is, and that's hello, ladies. I just thought it was hilarious.
He's so over the top, and I think, I don't know if Clancy Brown was enjoying himself, but it seems just like the character is enjoying himself so much and it like kind of drunk on power.
Well, he goes the other way, doesn't he? So like, so he's like the opposite to how, you know, McLeod is, in that he's very much like, again, I'm using film examples, but a bit like Cast to Try and Face Off, very much like I'm here for a good time. I'm probably not going to be around for long. Let's just enjoy the big ride, baby. I think that's kind of the same feel. But again, he's absorbed that much power that, yeah, I'd not thought about that. He probably is just like mad on power, but evil at the same time. Now, I don't use evil very often because it's a bit like saying someone's naughty. It doesn't mean anything, and it just gives them an excuse to be horrible. But it's like, again, with like the whole fight scene, and it's a cool fight scene, and you think, oh, this Kurgan's dead cool. And then he's like, whose is the woman? He's like, she's mine. He's like, not for long. And yeah. To be fair, I love the reaction of Ramirez just to spit in his face. Yeah. It's like, oh, here's how horrible this character's going to be. And instead of it being like, oh, God, he just spits in his face. Like, you disgust me. He doesn't say it, but he doesn't need to say it. And then, again, right. That's something that I love about this film, that a lot of the time they don't have to say it, but you know exactly kind of what's going on. Saying that, the World War II flashback scene where he's like, you're the super, what does he say? You're the master race. And he like guns him down. I was like, cheesy. Bit cheesy. And then obviously then the little girl he saves, Rachel, becomes his secretary. So did you have any more points on the fight scene? Because I feel like I just ran us past that bit, didn't I?
No.
Cool.
Might have something.
And again, like where McLeod says, love is for poets, like that. I can't do that. And I like the fact that he calls Rachel out as well. He's like, don't you ever think about anything other than what you want? It's just like, yep. And again, with the song, like, Who Wants to Live Forever? What a song. The more and more you talk about this, the more and more I'm just like, please don't try and remake this, because I'll watch it and I'll review it, but I will laugh at it because it's going to be absolute shit. It's going to be awful.
I don't think you could get somebody to perform that song that earnestly in a way that wouldn't sound terrible. Like, it is just one of those things that Queen can pull off and very few other people can.
Well, yeah, it just makes sense. It just matches the film like so well. Queen are also very selective as well. Because like when they made Shaun of the Dead, they had to go to Queen and ask them for You're My Best Friend and a few of the songs they use in that. So like, yeah, it's that kind of thing. Like, who are they going to get? Who could get anywhere near? I don't know. I love films and I don't even know where to begin. Like, if they said to me and you, right, here's like a million each, figure out how to remake this film, I'm like, thanks a lot. But I don't know. I'd literally say, Patrick, I don't know where to start, mate. Where do we start?
Like, we would start by spending all the money and then giving them a terrible product, because it's what they're going to get anyway.
Well, yeah, good idea, yeah. But like, if
you can't, like, music's different now. You can't find anybody who does music like this that would work. And then, so the other option is just to use all the original music, but I feel like that's not going to work either.
Because it wouldn't fit, would it?
I don't think so.
And like, also, like, I mean, as much as I'm saying I try and do, like, if you then try and match it, but you're not going to match Queen, so should you then do that at all? But then if you don't do that, it won't feel like Highlander. But it's such an awful situation. Like, it's not that bad because you get paid, but it's like, right, what? How do we genuinely, mind you, I'm not being awful for whoever writes it, but this is from two people who clearly love it. So are the people that bothered? Like, I'm not saying they're not, but if they just want to like knock some out quick, then that'll do. It'll get rewritten about 500 times anyway. Who cares? So I just think, why?
And yeah. And, you know, they don't really make movies like this with songs like this, where you've got, you know, one band who is doing, you know, what, 5-6 different songs for the soundtrack. Yeah. It mixes in and out of the score, which is pretty cool sometimes. And then, like, the songs really match thematically and work really well. Like, you just don't see that.
No. And again, like, and when you do see them try and do this, the music either overpowers the original musician, whereas in this, you have Michael Kamen, and yeah, his theme really works. Like, his soundtrack really works. His original music really works. And you're thinking, I don't know how you do it. And part of me thinks, if you can't do it at least as well as, you're trying to do better than, or at least, but they'll probably do this new spin on it, and it'll just, it will. I hope it doesn't get made. As much as I like Cavill, I'm thinking, just jump off that ship quick. Like, just.
Yeah. Because I like him a lot too. But
I mean, the only hope is maybe he really, really enjoys it, and maybe he loves the film, and maybe he wants to. Because that's
the Witcher, that type of guy.
I never watched The Witcher. Yeah, oh yeah, he's like D&D the whole lot. I think he, hopefully he's learned from The Witcher in terms of have a bit more creative control. And hopefully he is somebody who goes, right, this is what my vision for it is. Because can you imagine, and again, I know I always do about, I like the fact that there's not a lot of special effects, but can you imagine the fact that if they managed to make this with the benefits of modern technology, and if you used it sparingly and used it properly, and I just think it could be like really a really impressive film. It could look really nice, but there's so many things that have to slot in place. An unbelievable director, an unbelievable editor, an unbelievable cast. I mean, Connery for one, you know, Clancy right. Brown, Christopher Lambert's, I think, underrated, isn't it? The women in the film who, I haven't written that. Is it Roxanne Hart?
Right, yeah, plays Brenda. You
know, yeah, great. The lady who plays Rachel, really, really good as well.
Yeah.
Like, barely in it, but really memorable. Gives a good performance, and you're thinking, yeah, this is good stuff. Even like the cops, as daft as they are, the little scenes in the street, you just think, you're not going to be able to do this. Like, please try something else. Use Henry Cavill and the team you've got to make something new. And hopefully, we'll latch on to it if you make it well enough. They seem to just panic and be like, oh, let's make something that people know. Yeah, but we're never going to get anything new. Like, God's sake, just, there must be some filmmakers that are tearing their hair out. They really must, because... But, you know, yeah, so it flashes back again, and Blossom, I think, Heather, she's getting older. And again, like... You know, yeah, the prosthetics aren't great, but the makeup isn't great. But I don't care. Like, I genuinely, sometimes you've just got to go, I genuinely don't care. The film, it's not enough to make it even care. And that's coming from me.
Because the moment's really good, you know?
Exactly, yeah, yeah, exactly.
The actors really sell it.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. She's like, oh, light a candle and remember me on my birthday. And again, about these little moments, like, of little choices characters make that are so in keeping with who they are and when they lived. And she's like, leave me be, let me die on my own. Like, I don't want you to see this.
Yeah.
I was like, that's born from such a place of, like, love and a place of, like, but it's not overstated. They don't tell you that. They just let you enjoy them. Not enjoy. They let you appreciate the moment and appreciate like those parts of it. Like, because I think for people who look at this and be like, oh, I don't really like it, it's a bit goofy. I'm like, you're missing an awful lot. Like, even if you don't like it overall, there's still some moments in here to enjoy. Right. I'd argue anyway. And then again, I'd forgotten that Hugh Quarshie was in this as Castagir. He was a Royal Shakespearean actor, and then he went on to star in Holby City. For years, as one of the surgeons, Rick something, can't remember his last name.
He's also,
yeah,
in Star Wars, or he's in The Phantom Menace.
Sorry, I know.
I should try to figure out how many more people were in Star Wars off the top of my head. Just keep bringing it up.
It's fine. It's just like Patrick Star Wars trivia.
I don't even like Star Wars that much myself. I've watched all of them, but
I'm a
mid-level Star Wars fan.
Yeah, well, it's probably the best place to be right now. It's good stuff. But so I watched this entire film thinking, oh, it's a film about a Scottish guy. He knows he's immortal, and because they haven't taken the piss out of the English yet. Oh no, they had time. They had time. Don't you worry. Can't have I love Braveheart, but you can't have a film without that moment of like Hodgkiss. Although I did laugh when he runs off and gets shot. I really did laugh.
What's strange is, like, The actor is doing British accent, but it says it's set in Boston. It's very, because
yeah, but it would be English because it's set at the time where there was still a lot of English.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense.
Yeah,
because it's late 1700s.
Yeah, so there would still be quite a few around. You hadn't quite booted us off yet, so it's because she brings that up as well. Yeah, I'll resist the urge to sing Hamilton again on a podcast. and then we get the scene, which I think is probably the best scene in the film for, not the best scene overall, but the best scene for blending like the old and the new. So you get where Castagir gets beheaded, because you get this really, you know, New York City grimy backstreet. It's all grimy backstreets. There's no, you know, this is not glamorous. In the backstreet, pretty much next to the bins or the trash or whatever you call them. And they're having this sword fight. And then you get this clearly PTSD-ridden Marine who like runs out. Because I was like, who's he talking to? Because I'd forgotten this. Who's he? He's like, go Marines, go. And then he like, you get this traditional sword fighting. Castagir gets beheaded. Again, the beheadings look so cool as well. Didn't think I'd say that in the podcast. And then, then this Marine just absolutely like blows Kurgan away. And then... just gets like 3 foot of steel rammed through him,
picks him up, he's impaled and throws him.
Yeah, that's the only bit where there was a bit of really dodgy CGI where like the guy flips in the air. I was like, oh, it's that quick, it doesn't really matter. It just because there's barely any of it, it stands out. But yeah, I love that when that happens with people in films. I don't think it's very realistic, but have I just brought up realism in a Highlander movie? Yes, I have. Bye, everybody. You can turn off now. Now stick around Patrick's links. So the Marine survives, and it's about the only time the cops reappear. Like, is this the guy? And he's like, no. He's like, come on, it was dark in the alley. And the guy's like he stabbed me. That's not him. And the cop's just like, oh, shit. I like that. The fact the cop's just like, oh, Christ, it's not him. Even though it was, but they don't think it is because they think that it's the Kurgan doing all this.
Yeah. And I love that scene too, because when he starts to tell him about the quickening and everything, the camera cuts and the camera is like behind glass. You don't get to hear any of the audio and you just see the police's reaction to it. And they're like, this guy's insane. What's happening?
Well, yeah, because clearly he's describing it and we all know what it looks like. So those guys are like, this guy's cheesed enough as cracker a lot further than we thought. Although again, with these belly laugh moments, this is the biggest laugh I gave it. I've forgotten the bit where it's again with scenes you just don't have in films now, and what a shame. Where and remember people, it's a film, it's not real life. The bit where the Kurgan appears, he's just spliced that guy, kebabbed him. And he cuts off like half the top of this car and like rips the guy out. Yeah. Then gets in the car and he's like, mommy, or whatever he says to the woman. And then the car comes out of the alley and it's clearly a stuntman, but I don't care. She's clinging on the bonnet. Or what do you got? Do you call it the hood? The bonnet, we call it. She's clinging on to that and like her dress is going. I laughed so much. I couldn't help it, because it's like it's got, at times it has almost like a slapstick, like really dark humor, and it fits so well, but comes out of nowhere in I don't know. I really laughed. I really enjoyed it. Can't help it. And again with like, but I've said it a million times, but and I've written I love these little touches in terms of like when the Kurgan goes into the church and like, because McLeod's been in there and he's lit the candle for Heather, and I've remembered you on my birthday. And he walks in and he's just like, and he's like, he's a like kid. He's like, he puts them all out. I love that.
You know, you kind of mentioned this earlier that they have opposite like character arcs, but you know, the Highlander goes from like a young guy into like this wizened, old, tired guy. When the Kurgan is first presented, he is very stoic.
Mm.
And like I said, kind of becomes like kind of like this silly person in a lot of ways. And I do think that it's just the idea that, you know, they kind of mentioned like he's mad after all the killings. It's like society means nothing to him anymore.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't, would it? Because it'd just be a lot of minions and then a couple of pins you had to take out until you could become this superior being or whatever. But again, back to the scene that you were talking about earlier, where, you know, the protagonist and the antagonist get to sit there and talk to each other. This is where, because we had no inkling of it before, because all we see is him grab Heather, like by the neck, I think, or something. We don't see anything, and they don't imply anything. She doesn't say anything, and then he reveals that he assaulted her. And then because he says, "Oh, I assaulted Ramirez's woman," and he's like, "Oh, she was your woman," because Ramirez was trying to protect her, obviously. And
because he probably would have done worse if he knew it was, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, he goes to attack. Oh, yeah. He probably killed her or baited her or God knows, like, but used her as bait. I mean, I think that's why Ramirez was like, "Oh, she's mine," because he knew if he said it wasn't, it would be. Well, could have killed her or anything, yeah. And then of course he. It's not that they. I don't think it's that they can't physically kill each other or fight. It's that it's like an unwritten. It's a rule they can't do it. Because he goes to attack him, doesn't he? And then he's like, "I remember what Ramirez told you."
Yeah.
I don't even know what the voice is, but it works. Because apparently,
yeah. And I would ignore any of the subsequent films and TV series about anything for this one, because clearly this exists in its own silo of continuity.
Yeah. And then the whole it's better to burn out than to fade away. I'm like, yeah, I love how he is with the priest. But I also love the fact that the priest came over, or the father, I'm not sure which, came over and was like really respectful and was like, "Excuse me, there's people trying to pray and you're disrupting them." I thought, oh my God, because usually you don't see that.
Yeah.
Usually the guy would be like, "Get out." But he's like, "Look, there's people who are like, you're like, you're disturbing them. Could you please like calm yourself down?" Like, doesn't even ask him to leave. It's just, oh yeah. And then he licks his hand. He's like, "Oh, I'm sorry." Oh, yeah. His hand, doesn't he? It's
disgusting.
And then he like walks away, and the priest like crosses himself.
I think that probably reveals a lot about myself, that of everything he does, that's the part that icks me out the most, is him licking him.
Oh, it's sort of licking the back of your hand. Yeah, and he probably like licks almost up his sleeve. It's like it's intense. It's like it's not as intense as the quickening, but it's not far off. and then Connor reveals who he is to Rachel.
Brenda.
Oh,
Brenda.
Sorry. Brenda. Sorry. And he also says, "Father, forgive me, I am a worm." And I'm like, because it's almost like he's not insane, he's got the insight in there. He realizes how much a nutter he is. But I don't know. and then you're wondering, like, because I'd forgotten how it ended. I knew how it ended, but I'd forgotten, like, the setting of it, because it's been years. And I was thinking, I wonder how this ends, because it's been such a good film. And you think, "Oh, I hope they don't go over the top, or I hope the ending is not. I disappointed," but what a great fit! Like, what a great climax the film's got. No pun intended. They have the great fight on the rooftop, and then just like I literally wrote down, then you have the sheer visual perfection of the fight in front of the window. Like, that is just so like such a good fight scene.
I love it. That last fight scene's really cool. Like, it starts on the roof and then the roof collapses. So you got this kind of, yeah, and then they float. Like, they have that whole like two-tiered action, and then when they're inside, it's just beautiful because it's just like the silhouettes is basically all you see. It's really brilliantly shot and choreographed.
Oh yeah, beautiful. And given that this is from a guy who previously did music videos, you're thinking, wow, this is impressive. Because I don't know. I might as well ask. It's what a podcast is for. I was watching it thinking, this film almost feels ahead of its time in terms of its jump cuts. It feels like Michael Bay watched it and was like, there is another way. type thing.
Yeah.
Because there are moments where, but not to its detriment. It's not, you know, it's not like lens flare Abrams or anything like that. It's not to the detriment of the film, but it's very stylized. But I think if anything, if it came out now, it would look more modern. Like, it wouldn't look totally out of place. Again, another problem with, if you remade it, well, how are you going to, because this style doesn't look that different anymore. So how are you going to, how So I'll just finish there. There's no point even. My head will blow up, I think. then the Kurgan gets beheaded. Again, because Ramirez nearly beheads him. This is something you forget, because you wonder if Ramirez teaches McLeod and McLeod is going to kill the Kurgan. And how is Ramirez, who's the one teaching him, who's meant to be better than him, up to a certain point, how's he been defeated? But he nearly kills Kurgan. He nearly takes his head off. He just doesn't cut deep enough. And I loved, and again, yeah, the effects are a bit hawky, but I love like the way they shoot that.
Like where it slices him and you think that he didn't get him, and then his head just kind of falls backwards.
Like it's yours, cool. Doesn't it? Yeah. And again, with like, there can only be one, which is one of those lines. It's a bit like just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water. Mm-hmm. It's such, if you said that to somebody who likes films, that the even if they've never seen it, they'll probably know what it's from.
Yeah.
Even if it's just from that Sean Connery Spanish one, which would no doubt make you cry. And then he moves back to Scotland, and he reveals that he, because of the Quicken, he knows what people think all over the world, and he thinks if he travels around, he can help them understand each other. Yeah, if only. And he's old. he can grow old, and he can now have kids. And he's like, you never prepared me for that, you Spanish peacock.
And that is a really interesting prize, right? Like the idea of like you're living immortal, and the prize is to grow old and die. Like that's a pretty profound ending.
Well, yeah, because I don't know, it's just somebody who wants to live forever. Like it sounds like a blessing, but it's a curse.
Yeah,
because if you're the only one or a select group, then everyone around you is going to die. Everybody you love, and the more you think about it, the more you discuss it. It's just, we could, but it would be a very depressing podcast. But it's just not a situation that you want, that you anybody would want to be in,
right? Really.
But an interesting one to kind of muse over, because you would think, oh, it's there to live and see the future. It's like, yeah, but at a certain point, you're going to get to a point where like nothing, no one you ever knew from when you were born or when you grew up is going to be there. So, God, I mean, we all work with older or younger co-workers. Sometimes it's hard enough talking to them. Can you imagine people centuries out? You know, can you imagine thinking, I don't even know. And again, it kind of ends with Connery Ramirez saying, you know, patience, and essentially warning him to kind of use your power well and don't lose your head. Connery makes such a huge impression. I mean, because I think sometimes it's too easy to say, probably the best modern example in my eyes, or the one off the top of my head, is like Nicolas Cage, in that you can put an actor in a film and it's like they're going to make an impression. But it's impressive, even for someone like Connery, or who Connery was, that even he could be in a film this little but make such a huge impression. Because I was sure when I went to rewatch it, he was in it for at least an hour, and he's like 20 odd minutes, 25 minutes. It's not
full a long portion time. In the middle,
yeah. But you get so much from it, and I don't actually think I've seen the second one, I might have. Years ago, but I've heard it changes things. But
the second one's terrible, and we're going to review it on our podcast. My wife doesn't know that yet, though, because it's set in the future, but a future that's already happened for us. So that's kind of what our podcast does. So I'm going to spring that on her. She'll love that.
Sounds, yeah. Not a Valentine's Day thing, is it? Because no, I've heard that's a pretty rough one. Did you have any points that we didn't get to? I think we've done a pretty in-depth one there, I think.
No, I think that covered everything. We talked about all of the major characters, which to me, this is a very, like, oddly enough, a character-driven film. You know, I feel like all of the characters are really powerfully drawn with short strokes. Like, you don't get a lot of them, but it really means a lot. Like I said, for me, the weakest part is the romance at the beginning. I like Brenda, but I feel like that doesn't work as much, partly because of all of the crazy tension in the modern times. You've got the police pressure. You got the Kurgan pressure. You wonder, like, how would you find time to fall in love? Like, it's kind of weird.
Well, isn't she, like, working with him at the beginning? It's the only bit I didn't quite... She's, like, working with him because
she's working with the police, but she's a sword expert.
She's a metallurgist, isn't she? So
Yeah.
Because at first, I thought she was part of forensics. But then she's like, but she comes after them, and they can't secure a crime scene for Toffee either. But I mean, you know, you could do a whole review on just the incumbency of those characters. But I don't think it's trying to say anything with that. I think it kind of drives the plot along. But I mean, to be fair though, I mean, to be fair to the police, you'd be baffled, wouldn't you? I mean, it's not. I mean, it's a very confusing set of events. It doesn't. It's not like they could sit there and go, right, where's the pattern here? Oh, right. There isn't one. Right.
It's multiple people engaged in a tournament of beheadings. There's not just like one culprit like that. Yeah, that's not a thing that you could solve.
They don't even work that out. So I don't know how they were going to, but yeah, no. For anybody who hasn't seen it, great film. I mean, just one of those films that, and I know this is going to sound cliched, but lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
And it proved that by, and I never saw the TV series, but it proved it by the fact that look how badly the second film went. And if there's anything more, this is like my last say on it, I promise. The second film of this franchise should tell you why you should not try and recapture this, because it can't be done. I never saw the TV series. The TV series is a bit different, so you can expand the lore and you've got time, and it's a little bit of a different medium, so you can look at it in a different way. What, you know, like the Indiana Jones, young Indiana Jones, it could be done in a different way, you know. So I'll let that off, but I've not seen them. But in terms of the film, you don't need to remake this. You don't need to do it. But they will. So, hopefully they don't, and this will just be superfluous in the future. Fingers crossed. But
for me, this really hits like a lot of things about film that I love. It's got amazing music. It's got amazing edit, and like the visual vocabulary is really good. It's got really interesting characters, and they're like, the acting is really strong. Like, people are going to complain about Lambert, but I like a lot of the choices he makes, maybe not all of them. Like, to me, it just works in a way that, you know, because film is this huge collaboration, and it doesn't take much for that collaboration sometimes to fall apart, and for everything to kind of build each other up in the way that it does for this one, like, really works for me. Also, the writing is pretty good.
Yeah. Thing is with Lambert's performance for me is that if he'd have, there's so many characters in this that are so, like, the Kurgan is so over the top. Like, not to a point where it's ridiculous, but so larger than life. The Ramirez character, it just so has that like mystique around them, a bit, you know, a bit like a, you know, what's his name?
Sean Connery.
Yeah, no, I was trying to think. See, I was trying to do a Star Wars reference, but I've forgotten his bloody name. The one who's, is it Ben Skywalker? A bit like Ben Skywalker, that mythical. I was, you know, mythical. Your Dumbledore, your Sir Ian McKellen. I've forgotten Lord of the Rings one. Jeez, Gandalf. That kind of mythical character who like seems to know it all. My point's gone anyway. So you've got all those characters that are like that if he'd have tried to like live up to that, or like be larger than life, or be like funny or whatever, I think it would have been like too much of the same thing. So I think it helps the film that you have like a little dash of something different in there. Someone who's just a bit quieter, just a bit more. Because he's taking no joy in it. He's like, oh, for Christ's sake, like, I don't want to die, but also, like, I can't have bothered to. I have a feeling if it wasn't such a bad outcome, he would just be like, well, I'll die at a certain point. Whoever wins, wins. But because the alternative is so bad, it's like, well, I'm going to have to fight him. I have to, the whole Harry Potter, we have to face each other in the end. That's my last sound anyway. But good film, great film, and I'd recommend anybody to watch it. Speaking of great things, I'm only halfway through your AI episode, but I'm really enjoying it so far. So I'd recommend anybody to go over there and give it a listen, because it is a little bit of a different idea, and to go through that idea, because it's not mine. I've read the website and I've read the blurb, but I can't sell it. So Patrick, would you like to explain what your podcast is and where anybody can find you? The shameless plug part of the episode.
Shameless plug. Okay. So Mystopian is a podcast that evaluates predictions from the past that are about the future that we now live in. So for example, speaking of movies, we covered Soylent Green, which was set in 2022. And we look and see like, what are those predictions? How good of a job did they do predicting the future? Usually the answer is badly, and we laugh at them. But we look at all types of things. So we do some movies, we do some books. We are talking about AI on the most recent episode that we have released as of this recording, which is kind of a different episode. We're talking about all the predictions that are being made right now about the future. And we're going to come back and revisit, because I have a feeling that they're not all going to be right.
Yeah. So I hadn't thought about this before when I was listening, but And I don't know if you'll have heard of it because it was a British TV series, but there was a TV series that ran on BBC One from 1965 to 2003, and it was called Tomorrow's World.
I did not know this.
Right, okay. So the whole idea was that they would look at science, technology, and they would look at they'd look at what was going on, what they thought futures were going to be like. So here's something that's going to be huge tomorrow. And sometimes it worked out and sometimes it didn't.
That's right up our alley. That's great.
See if you can find it. I've no doubt it'll be on YouTube. Because it's one of those things. It's not been over 20 years, but it was like one of those institutes of this is what we think is going to kind of come along. So things like flame-proof clothing and bulletproof vests and whilst presenters looked on, I don't know. So stuff like that.
It's great. I'm just looking at the Wikipedia right now, and it's got like artificial grass, digital watches, barcodes, and these are from like 68 and 72 and 83. Like that. Yeah. I'm really happy you turned me on to this. This is going to be great.
No, that's all right. Yeah, no, it's, yeah. So I just thought, oh, yeah, that'll be a good one. Don't know if the Americans had a similar or whether they're trying to remake it. I don't think they did, but yeah, give that a go because that no doubt be interesting. But no, did you do your link? Sorry, I've lost.
Oh, no, I didn't. So you can find us at Mistopian Pod on social media, but we barely use it. So feel free to not find us, I guess. But you can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and our website, which is mistopianpod.com.
Spot on. But yeah, thanks. Thanks to Patrick for coming on. And thank you to, jeez, I can't talk. Thank you to Patrick. No, hang on.
Thank you, Sean, for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been a great time.
Yeah, you wanted to wrap up for me. thank you to Patrick for coming on. And you're listening to Review It Yourself, the podcast with the Psy. Film reviews with no politics, no pandering, and absolutely no point. You can find us on Twitter. It's at Yourself Review. And we're also on Instagram. It's Review It Yourself Podcast 2021. I say we, it's only me. So if you are going to message me saying, you want me as a guest or you want to sell me something, please don't say I love what you guys are doing because there's only me. So at least have a listen first because that's just laziness. And on that note, cheers, everyone.
Get it in, get it on, and enjoy the vlog.
Welcome to Film Vloggers.
Oh, harder, Daddy.
The only film review podcast, thankfully, that poses the question, does watching this film feel like flogging a dead horse?
There he is, beating that dead horse!
Introducing your hosts. First up, her Irish potty mouth turns the air a whole new shade of blue. It's Fiona! Say hello, Fiona.
And why the f*** is Dan Mackers doing our intro?
I want to be gold!
That's great. It's great. She's adorable. And your second host needs no introduction. The man, the myth, the legend. Like, I said I'd do this for you. I'm not reading this. It's the guy who waffles too much. It's Ben.
Cooey!
I'm making waffles.
So what are you waiting for? Grab your whip, mount your dead horse, and let's get on with the vlog, shall we?